think dogma has been very... you have dedicated a lot of work in the past years on the question of housing and somehow also trying to dismantle certain ideas of household on the basis of historic analysis. And I think this is also why we were really lucky to have you. Geronimo Foss and Jessica Sert represent the Realism Working Group. And I think you're going to start to explain a bit your approach, also how you as artists relate to housing and maybe something that is very special or specific to when we talk about housing or living for artists. Very often it raises the question, how does that relate to work? And this kind of blurring between life and work is certainly one of the topics that we would like to discuss within the next hour.
Hello. So, thank you, Nikolaus, and thank you, HKW, for inviting us to this very interesting project. Which one? This one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, before we talk about the building you see on the screen, we say a few words about this group that we're in. It's a bigger group, but... for this project, we've been three people, so Jessica, Martin is in the audience, and me. The Realism Working Group was founded in 2007, basically as a discussion on realism among artists, critics, writers, graphic designers, so basically the different protagonists of the cultural industry. So... it's not exclusively visual arts, but that was kind of the starting point in the beginning. So, first of all, we dealt with the reconstruction of the, and also the continuation of the historical debates on realism in relation to our own practice. And in a way, in realism, we found an artistic discussion that was always closely related to collective practices. And this also then... brought us to the HKW in a way.
We understand realism not as a celebration of reality or as a naturalistic representation, but to the contrary, as a perspective of appropriation of reality. This reality for us goes throughout all the spheres of reproduction and production. So we don't only want to discuss about realism in relation to our artistic works or do artistic works about realistic topics, but also we want to discuss it and also prove it in relation to everyday life. So in the recent years, among our discussions and projects, the issue of housing became a major topic for us. It's great to work as artists, so we don't want to miss the liberties that are connected to this sphere of work. It's for us, it's a working sphere in which you can also organize yourself as producers. And in our working sphere, as most of you might know, the cultural industry is a sphere of extreme exploitation.
In this, let's call it the misery of the cultural industry at the moment, collective self-organization is not just a good idea or like some kind of idealistic approach or something, but in the sense of realism, it's a realist perspective. It's something that actually makes things possible that are maybe not possible in the usual entrepreneurial setup of the cultural industry. So in Frankfurt, we were involved in various attempts of squatting buildings and different initiatives keep trying to appropriate space in Frankfurt, which is extremely difficult. Also, artists were part of this, not only us, of course. But these squats always ended in evictions. Voluntarily, people left because they didn't want to confront the situation, or, of course, because of police interventions. And one of these squats was the building we see on the screen, the Philosophicum, which was a former university building owned by the city of Frankfurt. And we were involved in this, but it was a big initiative. Jesse, why?
After squatting this building without success, we joined an initiative that tried to buy the building. We can show here a video of the building, of its steel structure that was so interesting for us because we could integrate certain uses from living and also working together. That was very important for us. We had to plan together, sit together in among the people of the initiative and discuss this out, fight for studio spaces and also plan it in a flexible architecture kind of way. What you see here are the rooms that supposed to be our studio space. We invented a flexible architecture, and by doing this, more and more our plans concretized that we really want to live and work together also among our artistic collective. And with the Realism Working Group, then we organized an exhibition that also had the goal to communicate our needs and give our proposal for the building and for buying this building with the syndicate model form, in which we ourselves contributed artistic works, but also try to organize our attempt to going further to the official sphere of the Frankfurt City press and so on. In the end, we see here one graphic that communicates the Philosophicum inside of the syndicate model. In general, we have in the syndicate model, we will talk about it further a little bit later, a lot of houses, up to 100 houses are now organized in the syndicate. And this is, for example, one graphic of Martin Stiel that communicates that one house is part of a bigger syndicate model and was one work in the exhibition. In the end, the Philosophicum building was sold to a higher bidding investor after about 2 years of political fights in the political sphere of Frankfurt City. And we are still very sad about this, but don't want to stop our investigation in housing, and we'll go on now.
Yeah, this group of 130 people shrinked after this project failed, and so now we are about 50 people that are also searching in the areas around Frankfurt for a new option. And searching for new options also influenced our collaboration with Dogma very much, but also the experience of thinking about the option to actually live in such a flexible space in this kind of, it's a post Second World War modernist building built by Ferdinand Kramer. So this also very much still kind of, the thinking about how one could actually live there still goes on in our minds and also in the search for the new project. I would then, this is one of the drawings that Dogma created in the context of our collaboration, which kind of also deals with the steel structure and with the idea of flexible typology of building. This is the a drawing of the exhibition contribution that we that you can see in the exhibition, where we have the inhabitable wall that Dogma will talk more about, and so like the individual space and the social space that we simulated with projections. So the window view outside is a projection, a backside projection, and the on the other side the social, the shared space, which is also a projection and a simulation of that. And part of that social model and the shared space, so to say, is the idea of the syndicate of tenements, which was from the beginning of our interest in housing and the possibilities of housing for artists as well, for us as artists, was the syndicate model, in German, the Mietshäuser Syndikat, which was invented about 20 years ago in a city called Freiburg in Germany. And so, is this the, my part? You already said that it's a project or an association of house projects that in Germany comprises about 100 house projects. And so when you buy a single, or when you appropriate a single object in this model, then it is owned on the one hand by the association of tenants, the local association, and on the other hand by the kind of trans-regional association of house projects called the Syndicate of Tenements, which is visualized on this slide. Somehow this should work as a pointer,
yeah.
But
I
you can't hardly see
yeah,
that
yeah.
One. So this is the Syndicate of Tenements, and these are the local tenants, and both own the object. And this makes possible basically that once a building is acquired in this model, it cannot be reprivatized because the syndicate of tenements has a veto right and can always stop any kind, any attempt of privatization or reprivatization of a building that was acquired in this syndicate model. So it's a model of collective ownership, basically. And the way you, this is, I think, your.
Yeah, I can explain this. This graphic explains how a house could be acquired in the model of the syndicate of tenements. About 1/3 of the overall budget, which is the pointer.
Just this one.
Ah. This group of persons that you see here functions as the supporters, friends and supporters. If you want to start to acquire the budget to buy a house, you will start to give your house a certain image that attracts people to invest in your house. This is also one important interest of the syndicate itself. It can't be just any kind of house, but it should have a certain impact also, for example, on the neighborhood, or it should have a certain political interest. To attract friends and supporters that want to invest in buying your house, you will find people that, hopefully you find people that invest, supporters. The history tells that about 1/3 of the overall budget can be collected by this attempt, by friends and supporters, and the rest will be then collected as a regular bank, count as a regular bank loan. In the end, the individual tenant, which you see here, doesn't have to invest any private savings. That means that you can enter to live in the house just without having any private capital. You will then just pay your regular monthly rent. And this you will do ongoing. Even if your house is paid, in the end you will just go on pay regularly monthly rent, And from this rent, you in the end, or not exactly you, but the organization, will pay back the loans of the bank and the interests of the investments of the supporters. And finally, even this will make possible paying back a certain part of the money to the syndicate, what will then be able in the end to also finance new projects for the syndicate.
So part of this contribution that we developed with Dogma, and also you can find it in the publication we did, is that we kind of speculated on what a society of syndicates could be, and that, yeah. And I have to finish here, but you can find that in the book, but it's basically, we think, an idea of, well, actually that syndicates can construct society in general, and then other things can be possible beyond housing, and maybe we leave that open to the discussion.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you and good afternoon. I have to say that it's very comfortable to be sitting on these chairs, but when you're here it's quite uncomfortable. I think it would be nice also to have a more kind of, discussion, like presentation rather than this very, very, very divided kind of line between audience and speakers. Our project, our contribution to the Von Umfrage exhibition is partly actually triggered by the collaboration with a working Realism working group, and partly actually based on an ongoing research that we have carried on in the last years, which try to basically imagine what would be a form of dwellings or forms of domestic space, or if you want, forms of life that could go beyond what has always been the project of housing about, which is basically family living and all the kind of ideological, economic frameworks that this form of life has always embodied. In this particular project, we took the topic of the villa as a somehow negative utopia that has really reinforced in a way the ideology not only of the house and domestic space but also of private ownership, and basically it's a process also of commodification that, as it was explained before, and in a way the project is really an attempt to take this quintessential emblem of the way in which housing has always been a form of exploitation and to transform it in what we have defined as a communal house. And the Realism Working Group was very keen to give us, or let's say inspire us, with a specific framework which they have trying to organize. So, in a way, as to be more precise about our approach to the question of the domestic, we have been very interested in this relationship or almost overlapping between life and work, which has always been the case. In a way, life without work has almost ever been existed, and I think this is, of course, a fundamental problem. But today, actually, this overlapping of an indistinguishable boundary between what we call life and its purpose as a form of production is even less distinguishable, and to the point that we don't even realize anymore when we work or when we don't work. And of course, this is a nightmarish condition, so our research is not trying to claim this as a kind of new, amazing, let's say, place for proposing a new kind of architecture. I mean, we are very aware that it's a kind of problematic condition that nevertheless can be either challenged or can be used to lever certain structural problems that are very much ingrained in the problem of housing, and in a way could also allow to question, you know, why housing, why we have to still actually believe in such a thing that seems to be almost a natural condition, a natural habitat for us, but has been historically constructed. Our research started in a very simple, I would say, very architectural way, studying actually forms of dwelling that by sometimes very accidental and non even political reason had challenged the way in which dwelling has always been structured by very specific rituals, most of them built around the notion of the family, but also more recently between the ideological separation between production and reproduction. As you know, since the 19th century, or let's say since the invention of modern housing, there has been this kind of idea that the housing is not a workplace. Although, as it was been described before, they're very tied together. Nevertheless, since the 18th century, the house has always been projected as a kind of space, a remove from the realm of production. And this is actually very important in the emergence of the interior. So that's why we were very interested in those conditions in which sometimes artists, sometimes normal people have misuse, actually, or use in a very particular way their family dwelling place, like, for example, in the case of Marcel Proust, who, as you might know, used to actually work on his bed and actually puts all the furniture of his room, including the table, against actually one side of the room, in a way transgressing the way in which the room was somehow organized. Or, for example, John Sona, who totally destroyed actually the very idea of the terrace house, which is a quintessential domestic space defined for the bourgeois family, and transformed actually this house into a studio, but also into a museum. Of course, I'm not saying that these are good example, but they shows how when that process of separation of workplace and domestic space was initiated, somehow there were different figures who actually were very resistant to actually being, let's say, kept within that kind of distinction. Or for me, actually, one of the most interesting cases, the artist Giorgio Morandi, who you might know is a famous because for all his life he mostly painted bottles, basically still life. And actually what is really interesting that his studio was basically his bedroom, and he did it actually on purpose. He chose on purpose this to, first of all, save money from renting a studio, but also to kind of, in a kind of implicit way, reject the kind of cliches and the kind of forms through which art was produced at the time, especially by making the studio something completely outside of the domestic setting. And that's interesting how that kind of condition anyway influenced basically his work, his artwork, because at the end he would paint exactly those, the landscape, the objects that would be part of his life. But of course, today this condition is no longer, the living and working in the same space is no longer a choice or a project for most of us. Is actually a condition where, in fact, let's say the bedroom or any kind of domestic space becomes always an improvised workspace, which of course creates this kind of continuous stream of activities and performances without any time, let's say, or spatial boundary. Of course, while we were working on this thought, we were also challenged on how to basically lever them as a possibility to propose a project. We were, of course, very much haunted by the topic of this conference, but also the exhibition, Zur Wohnungsfrage, which, as you might know by now, of course, is a famous pamphlet by Friedrich Engels, where Engels actually made quite clear that the problem of the way in which capitalism has commodified or create an unjust society cannot be solved by building housing or making new houses. And actually, one of our professor at school, Manfredo Tafuri, used to comment this text by saying, there is no actually a working class city, there is only a class critique of the existing city, and therefore any attempt to build, to use architecture to solve the problem is bourgeois socialism, or at worst, a reactionary palliative. And of course, this has been a question, an issue that, you know, after reading this text, has always haunted the artists, architects, activists to use housing as a tool to, let's say, change, at least confront the situation we are trying to describe. Yet, I think that what I think is a problem of that text is that both Engels but also Marx put very much aside the problem of reproduction, and also how, and this actually is a very important point of entry for us, how within class struggle, domestic space has always played a fundamental role, not only in terms of economics and affordability, but especially in terms of constructing subjects, in constructing actually conditions that begins really at home, through which then society at large was reproduced. And I think that for, in that sense, especially for those who struggle here and now, the question of how to change or challenge forms of dwelling, as the example we have seen before, even if they are sometimes very marginal and fragmentary, can perhaps give a possibility for housing to be a tool to at least highlight a more structural condition. And of course, I think in that sense, it's very important to understand the relationship between production and reproduction, how these two conditions has always been tied very strongly together, how capitalism has always actually tried to naturalize reproduction and therefore the domestic space, housing. In a way, reproduction is really the model of, for me, the Ur model of exploitation at large, the way in which affective relationships, family relationships, in a way, it's an unpaid infrastructure through which capital has always reproduced its let's say, power. And how actually today, of course, especially in our way of living, these two things, these two conditions comes actually literally very often together. So the subject of our project, as it was clear from the presentation, is the artist. Of course, we take this subject in the wider generic sense possible. In a way, it could be as a graphic designer, a painter, a musician, a producer of wheelchairs, or an architect. And someone who, I mean, we are really trying to open up this category as much as possible, with a reminder, of course, and this actually goes back to the discussion before with Marta Rosle about hipsters, that where I have some kind of disagreement, by the way, to the way in which the very subject of the artist was political engineered, already in the Renaissance, to downgrade actually the artisan. And this actually really happened in that passage from the importance of manual labor to the importance of intellectual labor, in which the figure of the artist, of course, played a very important role. Yet today, actually, the artist is he or herself downgraded by a kind of condition that celebrates the ethos of the art world, but leave actually its producers or a part of its producers in a very dire political and economic situations. And I, for us, actually, this photograph by Jeff Wall called Young Workers was a very crucial reminder that behind the kind of sarcasm of the hipsters, at the end, in a way, artists or people who are involved in this kind of production are people who are workers, producers, and in actually among the most weakest segment of society, since actually they're also very difficult to politically organize. And in a way, projects like this, or what the Realism Working Group is doing, could be very helpful to repoliticize something that at best we can criticize as a kind of hipster culture. So that's actually where the question of domestic space becomes crucial. Domestic space has always been an ongoing process of primitive accumulation. So primitive accumulation doesn't stop in the Middle Age, as Marx or Engels believe, or with the kind of dispossessions of peasants, the house creating gender discriminations, creating actually the family, which come from the Latin word family, which means slaves, has always created a kind of servant affective condition, which actually architecture has always very much ideologize, I mean, naturalize within its spaces. And this kind of, let's say, primitive accumulation always works through a trinity of conditions: the condition of labor in the sense of reproduction of ourselves, which the house always tried to hide, or let's say, as I said before, naturalize; the condition of family. You know that 99% of the housing being produced even today is basically family apartments. Even when they are super small, they still have that kind of pretension to address the subject. And of course, the third point is property. I mean, the house is always built, whether you are a tenant, you are paying a rent, or you are the owner, the house is always meant to belong to someone, let's say, to a juridical person, whether it's a landlord, it's the state. There is always an owner in charge of this property. And in a way, the villa represents really the quintessential apotheosis of these conditions, also because the villa had a very specific architectural manifestation, which was to be outside of the city, to create this kind of fantasy of a pastoral world, remove from the realm of production and labor. But as you can see already in the Roman villa, for example, the clear separation between laboring activity, reproduction, where female and slaves would live, and then the more representational aspect of the villa itself. And this actually becomes very, very strong in what can be seen as the archetype of the modern suburban villa, which is Palladio's Rotonda, where you can see that the villa actually looks almost like a church that celebrates this kind of landlordism, you know, of the land, and all the reproductive functions are sink in the basement, in a way constructing this kind of illusion that you can live in the middle of nowhere, or let's say in the middle of your property, while all the services and infrastructure and the people that allow this the reproduction of the villa to happen are basically hidden strategically, and you can see that only in the, as you can see in the section. And of course, even in the democratization of the villa, with the introduction of the single family cottage, still the archetype dwelling in this kind of pastoral image was very important. And of course, the family becomes really the subject of this project. And of course, as it was being said before, this is has nothing to do with the private entrepreneurial, let's say, form of dwelling, but it was really orchestrated by the state through financial aid, through all kinds of politics of, let's say, subsidized, let's say, housing, in order to really to promote this kind of form of living, which, of course, we know today has so dramatically backfired, not only actually in terms of affordability, but really in terms of subjectivity. I mean, it has created really a kind of distorted, perverted almost idea of living, which is very much ingrained in also how people in general think the idea of housing, in a way, as a kind of very paternalistic, patriarchal structure. So our starting point for the project was the concept of urban villa. So it's a kind of slight kind of, reinterpretation of the villa, but not as a kind of isolated object. The urban villa is a very petit bourgeois, let's say, kind of building, which was introduced in the 19th century as a hybrid between a tenement and the villa. What is interesting is that urban villa is neither as small as a single family house, nor too big like a housing slab. And in the 1970s, it was proposed by Oswald Matthias Ungers as a kind of typology that would allow cooperatives or different kind of subjects to self-organize their form of dwelling. Of course, what is problematic about this project by Ungers is that Ungers saw this really as a privately driven strategy. Of course, this was at the end of the 70s, where most of housing was still built by the state. So in a way, this project was proposed as an alternative. And this is, for me, for us is the controversial aspect of the project. But we thought that this idea of using the urban villa as a kind of attempt to profanate the quintessential domestic archetype in order to allow a community to, let's say, 40 to 50 people to live together and to self-organize their own way of living according to the principles that the Realism Working Group has presented to you was a very important strategy. So from now, actually, Martino will really explain you actually how we answer to this brief through our project.
Okay. Thank you. I will try to use the few remaining minutes to explain you our proposals and also how we actually spatially relate to what you can see in the one-to-one model, which is downstairs. Indeed, we have started from the idea of the urban villa, which became a model for us, which was something that was not too big, not too small, and in fact ideal for generating a possibility of communal living for about 50 people. This proposal is actually built according to three main criteria. The first criteria is what we have just heard from both the Realism Working Group and Pier Vittorio, that in fact this initiative is framed within the organization of the Syndicate of Tenements, which is something that basically attempt to decommodify housing, as we have just heard before. Sorry. The second criteria has to do with the site where actually our communal villa is located in the city of Berlin. We have started this project by actually a process of exploration of the city, and we have discovered that in Berlin there are a lot of unforgotten, neglected, unseen site, which still today actually falls outside of current zoning plan. And this site became quite interesting for us as possible site where our proposal could be placed. And the reason for that is that often these sites are in public hands still. Often these sites are pretty much close to infrastructure, to public mobility network, and therefore offer facility and possibility to people to commute and to move through the city in a quite easy way. And also these sites are somehow characterized still by a sort of unexpected beauty, which in fact, in a quite paradoxical way, relate to the suburban green environment where the original idea of the villa was meant to be located. The set criteria, it's a very important criteria for the project, is that in fact we have started with this project a research which certainly is not completed and something that we will develop further in the future. Namely, the fact that we have attempted to build this industrial, this communal villa, which is actually declined in two actually different prototypes, one which is slightly more urban and one which is slightly suburban, as a sort of industrial building. This, of course, was done with the goal of reducing construction costs. And in the case of the suburban communal villa, we have adopted a prefabricated steel structure, while in fact, in the case of the let's say, more urban communal villa, we have adopted the concrete prefabricated structure with the goal, as I said, of drastically reduced construction cost. Of course, this is achieved not only by actually deploying a construction strategy which normally belongs to industries and a production plant, but also basically by getting rid of a phase of the construction process, which is the phase of the finishing, which on the one hand, of course, allow us to reduce cost, but also in a way allow us to get rid of all that sort of apparatus which so strongly, as we have heard before, characterize what is domestic space today. So the result of that was that we came to an estimation of the construction cost of this urban villa, which is close to 700 euro per square meter, which is actually a rather low level of construction cost. Very quickly, I would like to show you the organization of the villa, which is actually based on the definition of one living cell for one inhabitant, which is this little, let's say, square that you see in the lower part of this plan, which constitute a living cell which has a defined measure of 7.5 times 7.5 times 5 meter height, which is actually distributed and located on the outer edge of the building, and thus defining in the center actually what is the most important space of the entire project, which is the communal space, which is indeed framed by this, let's say, private space which is located along the outer edge. In fact, the whole plan is characterized by only one fixed, let's say, partition, which is what has already been mentioned, is a system of inhabitable walls, which is also one of which is also what you have you can see exhibited in the exhibition downstairs, which is actually the only fixed partition and the only actually furniture which is present in the entire villa, which is something that on the inside, toward, let's say, the space of the private cell, contains, becomes a sort of container of the primary facilities for to allow for living to happen, namely a sleeping alcove, a bathroom, a wardrobe, and a certain amount of, a generous amount, I would say, of shelves. While on the outer space, toward the collective space, it becomes a generous storage space where art material or art products could actually be stored. The idea is that, in fact, if we look at these collage or images of the inside, is actually to produce an architecture which is rather simple, which we could say is actually pretty abstract, but something that, in fact, becomes flexible not only in terms that, in fact, the space could be transformed, but rather in the fact that this space could be accommodated or could be used by actually different subjects, which could be older or younger, that could be male or female, it could be adult or child, so that all of that actually could pretty much fit into the space of this unit. A few more images of the space of the cell. If we come to the plan, actually the most important space is the space, the communal space, which is located at the center of the plan. There are few actually fixed functions which are mostly located on the ground floor level, where actually, for example, noisy workshop or other laboratories are located. Well, in fact, the main collective space is a space which is adjustable, which is flexible, which is actually that could be rearranged according to, thanks to a system of movable partition that in fact would allow to achieve different combination and different articulation of the space that allow also to, in a way, blur the distinction between forms of production and forms of reproduction, as I think it will be pretty much clear from the images that I will show now. But that also that shows that art production today is not actually the result of individual labor, but often is the result of collective labor. But also that, in a way, thanks to the legibility of the structure, the architecture would be able to allow for the inhabitants to freely and understand actually how the structure could be transformed and appropriated in the course of the time. To conclude, I'd like just to quickly show a few drawings that shows how actually the villa is located on some of the sites that we have selected that refers to the plans that I showed at the beginning. In this case, you can see the suburban villa. And it's quite interesting actually how this model is at the same time rather indifferent to the condition of the site. The villa is always the same in both its urban and suburban a model, but at the same time also it does not imply an urbanization of the site where it falls, but in a way it allows the site to basically remain open and explorable to the city as actually they are today. Thanks.
Yes, and maybe one final point that for us is very important. I think that what we were really trying from a maybe pure architectural point of view, what we were really trying to do was something that was really economically as cheap as possible, but we really didn't want to fall in this kind of tendency that is actually very strong now in architecture, that affordable means very small. Actually, we want to actually have something that was extremely generous, showing that sharing means not reduction of one own space, but let's say increasing of space. And therefore, also in the model, both in the room and actually, let's say in the villa itself, there is a certain kind of monumentality, which I think for us was very important to somehow go beyond this kind of austerity ideology that I think is affecting not only economy, politics, but we see more and more. Also architecture where you have on one hand these luxury pencil towers and then you have these containers like buildings for those who actually cannot afford. So in a way, the idea is also to re-instrumentalize the monumentality of the villa against its political and ideological premises. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll conclude with a short discussion and also Q&A to the audience. Maybe a first question, something that you, Jessica, and Geronimo have had to cut out due to time. The whole project is also, as you explained, very much about a collective. So it's really a collective housing project. From the architectural point of view, the economy, but also the kind of labor investment, as I might call it like that. I know labor has many, many meanings here in this project, but maybe you can briefly describe how that community would actually work together or live together, how also the tasks of living together collectively are distributed.
This is, first of all, there is, of course, like weekly meetings and painful long discussions and even bigger meetings once a month and all these kind of things. But then this was never put into practice, but the idea was, okay, if we live together, there's different needs and maybe there's different tasks to be accomplished somehow. How can we do that in the same kind of collective manner? And that would maybe include a different way of dealing with time in that sense, that we can kind of estimate how different tasks, what amount of time it needs to accomplish these tasks, and how that can be like distributed among volunteers. I mean, this is maybe a more utopian part of the whole project, but I think it's already embedded in the way that we have to organize the building in order to get the building, in order to, we have to make these meetings, we have to make collective decisions, and why not like do that with all spheres of activity in that space in a way. So childcare, I don't know, bringing out the dust, the dirt bags or something, and cleaning and renovation, and yeah.
That work now with the within the context of commodification, because we know that work and labor is connected to commodification,
yeah.
And it's something also that you mentioned, referring back to David Madden's talk this early afternoon. Somehow, this whole project also seems to be an attempt for decommodification, to take David's words. Maybe you can comment on this.
Yeah, actually, I was very pleased that David really talked especially about this process. I mean, for sure, of course, this is what we propose, both as Realism Working Group and Dogma is an attempt that might also have a lot of political, juridical, legal problems, but definitely that was the goal. And I think that what is interesting is how to withdraw housing from this concept of private ownership or property. I think this, for me, is a central question. And this question, in a way, is twofold. On one end, is a juridical question. In a way, actually, it's interesting to see the villa, because the villa is one of the first real estates being designed, invented to be resold, to be exchanged as a commodity. You couldn't do that with the house in the city, because the house in the city was also a sacred space, and therefore you couldn't easily exchange it. So in a way, the villa is really this kind of transformation of what has been, you know, a universal right to live in one place into an exchangeable product. But there is also another aspect of the question, which I think for us, for both collectives, was very important, that this process is not just a juridical process, it's also a spatial process. This process also implies that space has to be organized in a certain way. For example, if you know that when you design, you even make a competition for public housing, you will be always asked to design houses that are better than others. Of course, it will not never be said like that, but it's implied in the way, you know, diversity, you know, it's usually the kind of word. And I think, for example, in our project, we have developed this idea of equal rooms, which then inhabitants can decide whether to keep them equal, to make apartments within them, to transform them, to disrupt this kind of very rigid plan. But at the same time, you start with a canvas that, in a way, allow a counter the way in which space is hierarchically organized. And I think this is actually very important, and one of my frustrations sometimes with people who are very much active on the political side of struggle for housing and housing rights is how the spatial dimension is always taken for granted and never really problematized. And for me, that's really why at the beginning of our intervention I said why we never question housing as such, as a concept of living, which actually from the beginning of its existence has always implied a kind of ontological violence, inequality between its inhabitants.
I think given to time, we should probably immediately open up to the audience for questions, because I think there are many topics that have been discussed here that also hint to what we discussed before in the two sessions. I see a question over there.
Hello. Yeah. This is a question for Aureli. You have been... well, first of all, I think it's a very convincing...
it's not a question to me, it's a question to all of us on the stage, because this was a collective project, just to...
Yeah, but in this case, it's very much directed to you directly. I'm sorry.
Then it's not a question to be made.
All right. So, but I think it's a very convincing case that you're putting together. It's actually very... and everybody can see that how implementable it is.
Sorry, I can't see you. I really can't.
I'm right
see
here.
Behind the camera.
Ah, okay, yes. Thanks. Sorry.
And, but I've some perplexity about the terms, because you have been very fastidious in all your published work in dissecting the origin of words and what they mean and what the mixed use of it has been throughout the centuries. And so I find it troubling. I'm not really able to understand why would you call this an urban villa, because when you look at the object, it has nothing to do with what we think of a villa. And so perhaps maybe this is like a polemical operation, but I thought it would be better to come up with the new terms, because I think that in the society we live in, we keep using terms that have lost their meaning, they've become something else, and this is a source of confusion, I find. And I find this to be particularly the case in the reference that you made, which is this Unger's project, which was, of course, a very smart project, but it's a project that is somehow jinxed by this mixed use of words, which is something that is very typical of both Unger's and Kuhlhaas. And I find that this is something that we should be able to get rid of. I don't know if this is... And the second, and then I'm done, is that do you... I understand, it seems that this is very much related to provide housing for artists, but it seems to me that this is not just the only possible people that can use this, and in fact, it will work very well with immigrants forever or for everybody else, because it's like it seems to provide a good solution, a viable solution in the low-cost culture that we currently live in.
Well, I think that the last part of the question, absolutely, yes, and we never actually we were very careful, and there was a lot of discussion among us on this point to not make, let's say, the artist a kind of specialized dweller, but to use actually more as a, in two ways. One as a kind of emblem or paradigm of the way in which everybody works, where in fact this kind of precarity becomes a very important condition. But the second is also because...
Also in a biopolitical dimension.
Yes, in a biopolitical dimension where, you know, this condition of life and work is very, very important. But there is also another point that for us was very crucial. We didn't want to patronize people outside of our condition. In a way, you can say that this project is a project for us, for the way in which that is confronted with the problems that which we live constantly, with the questions of how to live together, how to organize ourselves. And I have to say that sometimes I found very problematic the way architects think or artists think themselves as being outside of the picture and solving problems of others who they believe are in urgent need. And they completely ignore how they have become really part of the picture. I mean, we don't have anymore that detachment that was possible before. And for the actually use of words, well, I think I don't believe that there is a kind of, in words, a kind of a ultimate objective meaning. For me, there are historical use of certain terms. And actually, the history of the villas for me is really interesting because now the image that society have of the villa is the single family cottage. But in fact, if you see an example from Roman times, where actually the villa was somehow invented, to Palladio, the villa has always looked completely different. I mean, its history is made of a multitude of models. And the only thing that has remained constant, which was exactly what we were trying to change, was its actual economic framework, which is basically the possibility to colonize and exploit the land and to create this kind of microcosmic pastoral dimension.
And also, what I like about the word villa is that it's definitely not the stereotype or picture of the social housing, which is tiny and kind of, especially now, speaking in a German context, associated with austerity in a way, like that, as if people that have not much money have to live in very small spaces. And I think it should be the opposite. I mean, like, we wanted to, with this model, make something big, but that is actually realistically cheap at the same time, and yeah, and it has also like maybe an hedonistic approach to this. So, and we all have our experiences with living in squats, we all found out, and we don't want to do this forever.
There are other questions somewhere.
There is a question there,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Kind of a long question here, so bear with me. But it also, like, it relates to your project in relation to the analysis of housing in the first presentation. It's always struck me as kind of weird that there's this, you know, been this like a revival of the idea of the commons, and it goes with this narrative that there used to be these peasants who had this like commonly held land, and then somehow capitalism came and took it away. And I understand that when you move through spaces like Columbia and things, you can't say communism, and so you say commons. You can't say Marx, and so you say Engels. But what this references is the feudal system. And I know that there's lots of conservatives who would like to go back to this idea of a moral order or a community which exists, you know, before the rationalization of capitalism. And so I thought it was really good when the first presentation ended with an invective against moralism, and how you showed the Villa Rotunda and performed the kind of feminist critique of showing that the problem with this like the humanist kind of like the mathematics of the Villa is that it's predicated on not on most people not being human in that model. And so, but then once again, the 9-square grid shows up in your villa, and you have like the community that meets in the middle, and you reference like the modernist project of breaking down the family, and breaking down the bourgeois subject. But then in the Invocation of Realism, we have this history of the conflict between realism and the modernist abstraction, and the kind of like the moralism of like the Stalinist socialist realism against, you know, the amoral abstraction of constructivism, which has like been, you know, inscribed in like the Bauhaus, like the no sinner pinwheel. And so it seems obvious that the kind of the tragedy of the modernist project is that like the only real abstraction that we have at the moment is this like is finance capital and the way that it like annihilates us space and things. Like, is there a way to imagine an alternative to the commodity form as the only value form without, you know, without resorting to this realism of like, oh, we need new families, we need like a new kind of like force, and the force of law handed over to community or to like moral orders? Or is there a way to be, you know, is there anything left of that modernist vector away from like the individual subject and away from this, you know?
Of course, you can have other possibilities. I mean, we certainly don't want to propose this model as the solution at all. I think this is an attempt, and also I want to make clear that for us, to rethink the relationship between individual and collective space is a very important point, and of course, it's not enough. And the whole form of the villa for us is a kind of secondary issue. And I agree with you that in those kind of projects, there is always a risk of evoking ghosts and specters that, in a way, have always haunted the domestic project. I don't think there is a fully liberating domestic project. Even the grand domestic revolution that Dolores Hayden was writing about 30 years ago had aspects that were very problematic in a way. But still, I think that it's a struggle. I mean, I don't think that housing, it's only this condition where housing produces subjects. I think that also the indwellers eventually reacting against what is proposed to them can propose their own interpretation of space. And what we offer might look very stable, and he actually wants to be stable in a way. He wants to actually counter the ephemerality of the commodified house, as it has been described. But he also wants to, in a way, allow the dwellers to at least understand the conditions, the basic conditions in which they dwell, notwithstanding all the issues that you mentioned, which are problems that I think remains on the table. I mean, we are not proposing this as a kind of recipe. We are proposing it as a kind of both slightly pragmatic attempt, because of course there are here people who are really struggling to afford these living and working conditions, and use that as a way to open up the discussion on this question of the domestic away from the family apartment, which is, as I said before, 99% of what is produced today as housing.
Okay, thank you so much to all of you, and we'll have a short break right now, although we have a hand there, but please ask during the break. We'll have a
with a
break.
Beer is much better, I think.
Yeah. We'll meet again at 5:30 for the next presentations. Thank you so much, all.